Don't think anything wrong with that.
You know, I want to say this. Ladies do a lot around here. And I always appreciate it. And I'm often afraid to compliment or say things about what they do because then maybe I didn't compliment all the ladies equally or whatever else. And you know, I used to rave because Sandy and Bev would come in here and clean. And I mean, when Sandy and Bev cleaned, I mean, it just, there was a thoroughness. They grew up in this church, loved this church, and you could just see that extra touch on it and such. You know, about 2 weeks later, my wife would say, "You don't like how I clean?" I'm like, "What are you talking about?" You know, and then when it dawned on me, you know, it's I rave about them, but I don't rave about how she cleans or whatever. So, but and because she's a human being, she's just like the rest of us. But, you know, so I often don't say anything, but, you know, the Bible says this, that the woman is the glory of a man. And, you know, when I see the ladies down there taking care of the kitchen and doing things and such, it really, gosh, you're doing a great job, but it brings a lot of glory to their husbands and such. But I thought of that thing yesterday with Miss Ashley putting on something that was above and beyond the call of duty. Bringing together all Dale's relatives and friends and church people and everything. And actually, just a great job. It just was above and beyond the call of duty. And I just woke up this morning thinking you brought such honor to your husband and your church. And that's just a blessing, all right? So if you would, go with me to the book of Job chapter 2. I'm just going to do some gleanings from the book of Job. Job is an amazing book. Again, you've heard me say it's the oldest book known to man. Now, there are older collections of writings. The Egyptian Book of the Dead has passages in it that are older than the book of Job. The Vedic scriptures that the Krishna people carry has passages that are older than the book of Job. But when we talk about a book that has characters and a plot, a beginning and an end, there is no older book on earth than the book of Job. It is the oldest book. And Job is a picture of many things. The Bible starts out telling you he's an upright man that eschews evil and such. And so you say, well, gosh, he's a saved man. But keep in mind, what did the Apostle Paul speak about himself prior to coming up with Jesus Christ? He said, as touching the law, perfect. Imagine under the anointing of the Holy Ghost writing down that when you were lost, you handled the law perfectly. You know, Paul's the only man I know of that could have done that. And yet he said it availed him nothing. And, you know, he counted all that but dumb. And that's all he saw that as, to have done that, for the excellency of the knowledge of Christ Jesus. So we start out with Job, who in the sense of how the world measures, and even God measures by the law of God, he's an upright man that escheweth evil. And yet at the same time, God knows what would happen if he were to challenge that. He were to push on that house. Blow on that little house of cards. And if there's any one lesson in the book of Job, and there's many, many lessons in the book of Job, I don't care who you are, I don't care what you have going on in your life, it wouldn't take much for God to upend it all and absolutely make you bitter, awful, upset, grieved, wishing you were dead, and that God can do that to you. Okay? And God knows he can do that to you. And it's the mercy of God that Jeremiah said that we're consumed not. Okay, that's just God's mercy that he hasn't come and done that to us. So I want to start out with many different gleanings from the book of Job. But Job chapter 2, and I want you to look at verse 4. We know that Job passed the first test. Okay. God's, you know, he was allowed to hit Job, but he wasn't allowed to hit him. He couldn't touch him personally. And you know, Job probably would have preferred the second test first. Because you'd rather have your own life tore up than have your children die. All right? You know, you'd much rather have your own skin turned to all sorts of sores and putrescence and such. But God knows what he's doing. And so the devil, though, he looks and he sees all this. And, of course, Job answered properly. He said the right things. And we're glad Job had excellent character. But in verse 4, and Satan answered, the Lord said, skin for skin, yea, all that a man hath will he give for his life. And, of course, the dark minds of history have always believed that. They've always believed the idea that a man can hold things dearer to himself than life itself has always been a puzzle to the wicked. You know, it's one of those things that yesterday when we met and we hid behind that wall waiting for Dale to come, a wall honoring veterans in the years that they served in the military and such. What are those? Are men that honored their country above their own life. Again, there was a man by the name of Chesterton that said this. He said that when a soldier stands there and shoots at a man in front of him, he's not shooting because of who's in front of him. He's shooting because of who's behind him, who's protecting, what he's guarding here when he does that. And so it's one of those things that the devil's just assuming that's fine, but if we put his life on the line and such, we'll see him crumble. We'll see all that fall apart. And verse 5, it says, but, and it's not going to take away his life. He says, but put forth thine hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and curse thee to thy face. Now, isn't it interesting? He didn't say touch his skin. He said touch his bone and his flesh. Now, where's that term come from? Where's the first time that term's used? Well, go back to Genesis 2, verse 23. Here's what Adam said, talk about Eve. And he said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. You know what the devil said? Touch his bone and flesh and curse thee. What's the very first words out of Job's wife's mouth?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Curse God and die. All right? When a man gets in extreme trouble, count on the devil to try to get the woman to curse.
Yes, sir.
Okay? Count on it. Doesn't mean all women will. But it's one of the attacks. It's one of the hard things. You know, one of the most fascinating essays out there is an essay called The Wilding. Take the word wild, put an ing on it. The Wilding of Sarah Palin. It's written by a girl by the name of Susie of Berkeley, who's a pseudonym. It's a woman who's at Berkeley who cannot write openly, okay? Because Berkeley, you'd suffer physical violence there to say conservative things openly. It's called Susie of Berkeley. It's called The Wilding of Sarah Palin. And probably one of the most important essays written in a long time so that you really understand. And she talks about how traditionally cultures humiliate other cultures by abusing their women. So, when the Russians came into Berlin, there were 90,000 rape cases reported to the hospital the first night. And they say that only a small fraction of women even bothered going. Because for the soldiers coming home that fought and such to find out that your wives and your mothers and your daughters have been violated and dragged through the mud and such, it crushed them for life. It didn't just hurt them for the moment, for life. They thought, I couldn't protect her. And what that essay talks about is how the left immediately, when Sarah Palin was brought out there and made a major candidate on the stage, how she was dragged and sexually maligned and all sorts of coarse, vile things said about her and such, that they handled her just like savages do with women to demoralize the men, and how effective it was against the Republicans doing that. But the thing is, the devil knew that. So he says, touch his bone and his flesh, he'll curse thee to thy face. And Job didn't. Now his wife, that's why the Bible talks about the woman being the weaker vessel.
I'm not talking about a weaker mind. That's right. I'm not talking about a weaker spirit. What's your vessel? It's your body. Okay? You know, Amy can't bench press as much as Dale can. Alright? She can't. Ashley can't lift the things that Neil can lift. Okay? Jody can't lift the things that Chris can. The man's body is stronger. Let me tell you something. And I'll go back to something, and you've heard me make this theme a few times, but I'm going to go back and quote my mentor, Bill Randall, again. He just said, you know, he's had sickness, financial troubles, friends turning on him, all sorts of things in life have gone on. And he said, you know, you get these attacks against your spiritual welfare. But he said, to be honest with you, the hardest single thing is being exhausted.
Yes.
Just being exhausted. When you're exhausted, staying together spiritually is so hard to do. And a man must remember that when he's getting exhausted, if his wife's on the same pace and usually a greater pace, you better remember she's the weaker vessel. Or God doesn't even acknowledge your prayers. You come to God, oh God, we need to get out of here. Get out of here. I don't care what you pray. You got that woman there, and you want me to have mercy on you, and here's that woman, and you're giving her a hard time, and she's tired, she's exhausted, and such. And so it's one of those things that it's not that her mind is weaker, and it's not that her spirit is weaker, but it's that pound for pound, as you go through things, her body will weary before the man's body does. And a man who cannot keep that in mind when he's trying to run a family is a grief to God and a shame to the Christian walk. Okay? That's all there is to it. Now, going on a little bit more, let's go to Job chapter 5. One of the things that's talked about in the book of Job, I was talking with someone about 6 months ago, And I was quoting the book of Job, and that person, before you quote the book of Job, I want to know, is it Job talking or one of his friends talking? In other words, if you're going to quote one of his friends, that's no quote to me, all right? But if you're going to quote Job, now that's a quote that I can listen to. In other words, what do they mean? Were his friends right or were they wrong? Okay. So if you quote his friends, how do you know you're quoting something right? All right? Now I want you to watch something. Job chapter 5, this is Eliphaz the Temanite speaking. He says this, verse 12. He disappointeth the devices of the crafty, so that their hands cannot perform their enterprise. He taketh the wise in their own craftiness, and the counsel of the froward is carried headlong. You know what the froward is? The froward, one of the definitions is rebellious, but really a more accurate definition is somebody who's always answering different than you'd think just to vex you. They won't stay on the same page as you. You know, that's their delight, is to always, you know, not follow along with what you're saying and always just coming from another angle or something like that. That's the froward person. And you know what the Bible says in Psalm 18? With the froward, God will show himself froward. With the merciful, thou wilt show thyself merciful. Isn't that something? You have somebody who, you know, that's their delight, is to always be a little contrary, and it's their delight to never quite go along with things or whatever else. And then you go to God, and God just stays a little contrary to him and never quite goes along with him. To the froward, thou wilt show thyself froward. To the merciful, thou wilt show thyself merciful. And it's one of those things, again, where if you want mercy in life, and you know what? Out of the people that are here, 35, 40 people here right now, maybe one or two of you right now may be desperate for mercy in something. But sooner or later, every one of us will be desperate for mercy in something. Every one of us. And you want to have mercy in that day, show mercy to everyone you can. I'm not talking about foolish, bend over backwards, the people who don't deserve it anymore. I'm just talking about mercy. Mercy rejoiceth against judgment. It's one of those things, you know, if you ever stood on the line and wondered, gosh, I'm not sure what to do here. They're guilty, but I don't know if I should drop the bomb here or not drop the bomb. You know what? The first time, mercy rejoiceth against judgment. Okay? Mercy's the weightier part of the law. If you can show mercy, show mercy. Do that. You know, when Nathan, the prophet, came up to David, he goes ahead and he gives this long story about a man, and he talks about having that one sheep and raising it in his bosom and such, and his children playing with it. And by the way, I had a preacher one time tell me it's unnatural for people to love and hug animals. And they go, well, then why didn't David say, well, that sicko, what's he hugging a lamb for? And that, he didn't say that, did he? Not at all. Why? You know, because David, he knew what it's like to be a shepherd and hold that lamb in your bosom and find that affection with an animal. Nothing wrong with that whatsoever, okay? I've known people who've taken it to extreme. I understand that. We all have. Don't throw those in my face. Talk about the 99.99% of the people that handle it right, okay? Those are the ones we're looking at. But the point is, when that whole story goes on, he talks about how that man stole that one lamb. Now, what is the rule for stealing? The rule for stealing is you pay back fourfold. Okay? That's the rule. You know, you got caught. It says if a poor man steals, he ends up paying back sevenfold. You say, well, that's not fair. Well, what do you mean that? Well, because he can't pay back fourfold, so he ends up having to sell himself and go through 7 years of indentured servitude to pay it back. All right? That's why a poor man ends up spending 7 years, where a rich man only pays back four times if he steals them. Why? Because he can't pay back fourfold. So Solomon said, no man despiseth the poor man if he steals bread. You don't despise him. You understand why he did it, but yet he'll pay back sevenfold. And there's a justice in that. But under Israel's justice, at the end of 7 years, he has worked for a man. He's been part of the man's family, an indentured servant. And then it was to the man's righteousness and honor to set him back up in farming, set him back up in life and such, to be able to go out there. Israel took care of their own. But the point is, when David hears this story, he said, and the man shall die. Why? What in that whole thing was worth the death penalty? He says, because he did it without mercy. He did it without mercy. David didn't want such a man living in his kingdom. Mercy rejoiceth against judgment. Okay? A man without mercy is not a man even worth keeping around. I don't even want him around. That's when that finger comes out. Thou art the man. Okay? But God hath put away thy sin from me. And of course, David paid. He paid fourfold. He paid terribly for what he did. All right. So there's some gleanings here. But here's what I want you to see. It says in verse 13, he taketh the wise in their own crafty. Now I want you to go to 1 Corinthians 3:19. The Apostle Paul speaking here, and he says this: for the wisdom of this world is foolishness with God, for it is written, he taketh the wise in their own craftiness. Where is that written? It's written in the book of Job. Who is he quoting? He's quoting the life as the Temanite.
Yeah,
okay? So the point is, when Job's friends speak, they speak right. Except context. Okay? Let's say that I'm missing something out of my car, okay? And I can't find it. And then I remember, oh, Dale and Amy borrowed my car. Where is that? And then I go up, maybe it was an Atlas of Maps or something. And then I go up and see an Atlas of Map in their car. And then I give them verses on stealing. Are my verses correct? Is that the right context for them? No, that's not the right context for those verses at all, okay? So the thing is, that's what Job's friends are doing. They're going up to him and they're speaking to him things that are right. And if you think about it, you're going to put up with that an awful lot in your life. People go up to you and what they say is right, but what's vexing is that it just doesn't apply.
Yes,
this isn't the issue here.
Yes,
It's a false judgment
to put those things on you here. And that's what's going on with Job's friends. But the idea that everything they say is wrong, no, these are men much older than Job, and it said so. These are great men. Job was the greatest man of all the East, but these were very great men. All right? Much older than his father, he says. These are, and so we're taking men who go way back into the time after the flood, and these are men who would have known Noah, and they would have known Ham and Shem and Japheth, all right? That's who these men are. And so when they speak, you can bank on what they said. You know what Jesus Christ said about the Pharisees? He said, they sit in Moses' seat, therefore do what they say. But don't do what they do. He had confidence that if they opened their mouth, it was their righteousness to speak exactly right. Okay? But they wouldn't lift one finger to help one person do anything. They just go ahead, drop judgments on people and such. You know, when Israel came into the land, one of the things they were to do was to take big stones and stand them up and plaster them all over with white and then write the Ten Commandments on them. That's what the Pharisees were. All they were was these big stones, but you chisel into it, there's no heart of flesh in there. There's no heart for God whatsoever. It's just stones that can't help a single person. Just standing there saying what the laws are, saying what these things are. Don't ever get yourself into that situation where that's all you are. Yes. Somebody that can quote scripture at people and walk away because you said the right thing. So what if it's the right thing? Okay? If you didn't help that person, if you didn't lift them out of where they were, if you didn't give them, you know, comfort in what they were in and hope. What have you really done for that person? Right. You haven't done anything for that person.
Jump with me a little bit. Job chapter 6, the next chapter. We'll go to verse 21, and I'm just taking some gleanings out of the book of Job here. I've been reading Job for 40 years, and I think I understood it this time better than I've ever understood it before. It was almost like everything I've ever done in reading it before was prep for me to finally start getting it. Job chapter 6 says in verse 21, now this is Job speaking. For now ye are nothing, ye see my casting down and are afraid. And of course they would be afraid. You know, if you see a man as great as Job cast down, it would worry you a little bit. You know, well, what could happen to the rest of us here? Did I say, bring unto me, give a reward for me of your substance? In other words, Job said, look, did I ask you guys to come here? Did I ask you guys to come? And, or deliver me from the enemy's hand, or redeem me from the hand of the mighty? Teach me, and I'll hold my tongue, and cause me to understand where I have erred. He says, challenge them. Come on, fellas. Now they all try, right? They're all going to get up there, and they're all going to do their best. But Job's not thrilled with anything they have to say. How forcible, verse 25, are right words? And what doth your arguing reprove? Do you imagine to reprove words and the speeches of one that is desperate, which are as wind? Yea, ye overwhelm the fatherless, ye dig a pit for your friend. Now, one of the things you're going to see that goes on in the dialogue between Job and his friends is increasing accusations of the other one's evil. They're going to finally tell Job, well, you've been taking the fatherless and breaking their arms. All right, that's what you've been doing, Job. We know, all right? Nothing that's awful could have happened to you unless you've been doing that kind of thing. And so Job's really one of the first ones to get some of the licks in there. He said, yeah, I know what you guys are like. You go out there and see fatherless people dig a pit, they can fall into it. That's the kind of guys you are. Verse 28, now therefore be content, look upon me, for it is evident unto you if I lie. Return, I pray you, let it not be iniquity. Yea, return again, my righteousness is in it. See, this is the thing with Job, is in the midst of all this, he cannot let go of his own righteousness. Come on, fellas, come back and try to judge me on this. My righteousness is in it. And you know what the thing is? They never did penetrate it. They never did get it. They never were able to get there. I remember a friend of mine one time that had been under conviction for his soul for quite a long period of time. I'd gotten saved maybe 6 months or so before him, and he was under conviction. We worked together, and He used to go to church, and he'd go to altar calls and such, and he just couldn't settle this thing of his soul. And he told me one time, he said, you know, the altar calls, all these people come up and talk to me. And he says, when they're done, I think to myself, gosh, they really need to get saved. You know? And he ended up getting saved about 3-4 months. I think he'd been 6-7 months or something like that, under deep and heavy conviction and going to church and dragging himself around. And so he'd been raised in a Christian family. It's hard for him when he realized he was lost. So hard for people who have ever been deceived to get it right. And such. But I never forgot that. And say, you know, I go to these altar calls and these people talk to me, and I just think when they're done, gosh, that guy just needs to get saved. And you'd be amazed how many people just stand there and try to give advice and they don't know anything themselves.
That's right, yes, sir.
And that's what Job's going through. But he makes that mistake of saying, my righteousness is in it. Verse 30, is there iniquity in my tongue? Cannot my taste discern perverse things? And you know, one of the things that goes on, all of us have discernment. We all have it to different levels. And sometimes we can discern some things and can't discern others. Ulysses S. Grant could not recognize one tune from another. He had what's called a tin ear. All music to him was horrible, harsh noise that he just endured wherever he was. He had what's called a tin ear, and he could not recognize one tune from another. And yet, over and over, as his history is being rewritten, and it is being rewritten by tremendous historians are going back and looking at him now, and more historians are not calling him just the greatest American soldier, the greatest American general. I'm now reading behind historians are saying, this is the greatest general who has ever lived. And, you know, and yet he was so maligned and belittled and such. And there were horrible lies put on him about his drunkenness and such that they've proved since then were just horrible lies. But here's a man who, stunning in the ability to, to go ahead and he's the only man that understood what it would take to win the Civil War. The only man who understood what it would take to beat Robert E. Lee. The only man who understood what it would take to bring the South to their knees and such. And yet he could not distinguish one song from another. He didn't have that ability. God gave him so much ability in one place, he took it away from another. But we're all that way. All of us have places where we can see better than others, and all of us have places where we're blinder than others. And what happens, though, is we get puffed up and proud about the places where we can see more than others, and then defensive and bitter about the places, and act like, well, that's nothing, that stuff. You know, that guy can see that we can't see. And that's why God put us together in a body, that we're all part of each other, and we're together with each other, and we can lean on each other and such. And there's going to be times that some of you will carry far more than your share. It's just the way it goes. And there's going to be others that don't carry their share at the right times. It's just part of it. It's part of the learning process. It's part of what you go through. It's part of what makes a church a church. You know, Dale and I were talking this morning. When Dale first went and got a job, and you have to understand this, when people have been abused, and, you know, all of us at one time or another have been abused in something, okay? Some very terrible and awful inside. But one of the hard things is how unfair your abuse was. Because abusers try to make you feel guilty. That's the tool of an abuser, is making people feel guilty. If you are an abuser, here's how you start out. You start accusing the other person and making them feel guilty. Make them feel low. Make them feel like you're a terror. That's what abusers do. They make people feel guilty. And so it fills the abused person with anger because he can't say anything at that time. He's helpless. He's under this thing. He's under that thumb. And they're filled with anger, stuffed with anger. And so that when people go to deal with them later, it's like this angry person, and that anger is all in them, and anger resteth in the bosom of a fool. It turned them into a fool. It's destroyed them. It's hurt them so bad on the inside to have ever gone through that. So when a person like that goes to get a job for the first time, let me tell you something. If you have a job, going along with it is being treated unfair. It just happens. There's no such thing as a person who works somewhere gets treated fair 100% of the time.
Talk to any single person with, John, are you always treated fair? No. Okay? It doesn't happen. Chris, are you always treated fair where you work? No. None of us are. You know what? And it burns when it's unfair. It burns inside when it's unfair. And you know why you keep working? Because you have some character about you. You have a family to feed and such. But when an abused person sits there and they go and they're working somewhere and something unfair, they blow up. They can't handle it, okay? So I for years, I could have never held a job and such. They can't take it. And one of the first things I have to tell them is, and I remember telling Dale, you will be treated unfair. Don't even ask to be treated fair. It's not in the job description that you're going to get treated fair. If you want to live in an oppressive place, live somewhere where everybody's trying to make sure everything's fair.
Yes.
It becomes oppressive after a while. You know what? The world's unfair. It's just going to be that way. It's going to be that way. And you know what? For the abused person, they have to learn to put up with unfairness.
Yes, sir.
Things that are unfair. And once you can learn to do that, you can own the world.
That's right.
You can have it all. The abused person usually has a greater sense of discernment than anyone else. But it's a dark discernment. What do I mean by that? Jesus Christ said this. He said, if your eye be dark. Okay? What is it being a dark eye? The evil eye. It's where you see. You see a little bit more than others, but you're not seeing good. You're seeing the bad in people. I'll give you an example one time of a fellow that asked Ruth Ann and I, hey, can I take pictures of your children? We had all 8 children at home. And yeah, sure, you know, he's a family friend, kind of a goofy guy, but even a family friend. He's out there and he came in a couple hours later with probably the most cruel set of pictures I've ever seen in my life. Every time a child put his finger in his nose, picture. Okay. Which one of your children wouldn't sooner or later do that? You know, everything the child did wrong, he took a picture of. You know why? It's because all he saw. And he thought we were all blind to it. See? It's part of what his bitterness was. You don't see what your children really are. No, we've seen that. We know that. You know, we're not blind. Every one of us can get caught in bad. But there are people who have that evil eye, and all they can discern is the evil and the bad. And it fills them with bitterness, and they sit there. And the more abused a person has, the more that dark insight they have. And they just see all that evil inside of people. And if you've ever lived through a life of abuse, you know that's one of the things you've had to struggle against, is that idea. And then trying to see that good in people, that which is right with people. Go with me, if you would, to Job chapter 10. It's all getting to Job, and he says this, "My soul is weary of my life. I will leave my complaint upon myself. I will speak in the bitterness of my soul." Let me tell you something. It's always a mistake when I speak in the bitterness of my soul. I've never, ever been proud or happy or wish they could be memorialized, the things I said in the bitterness of my soul. When I get in that condition, there are horrible thoughts that come into my head. They're vile. That's why people who are caught that way are so unpleasant to be around, because it just keeps coming out of them. Okay? I knew a woman one time that, you talk about a woman with an issue of blood. She'd gone in for some radiation treatment in the 1960s, living in Chicago, and had a feminine problem, and they made a mistake and burned too much tissue off the uterine wall. And so she basically had her period for the rest of her life. It never stopped, okay? Just never stopped. And you say, what an awful thing, you know, just a grievous thing that have to go on, and what an injury to her to have happen. There's people who can't stop having diarrhea, just constantly comes out of them, no matter what they do and such. Well, there's people that are that way in their soul.
sir.
Where there's something wrong, the things that come out, they're just outside the bitterness of their soul what they speak. And Job has finally been brought to this place. Say, curse God and die. And really, in the end, he is going to come as close to that as you can. It's going to be rough, the stuff that Job says. You know, one of the things, it goes back to what Thumper told Bambi. If you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all. You know, if you can't learn from the Bible, learn from Thumper, all right? And, it's just that idea that in the bitterness of your soul, when your soul is, and by the way, you ladies are more easily prone to it because of the weakness of your flesh. But part of the effeminacy of our age is men are given over to us.
Yeah.
Okay? They're given over to it. The Jews have a word that we don't really have it takes us two or three words to say what they say. We're like, holy. That non-stop dripping complaining, hoy, okay, hoy, and that non-stop, oh my gosh, I need to know, I don't want that, hoy, right? And it's, you know, it's a very unpleasant word. Isaac Berkovich Singer, the great Jewish writer, they asked him why he still wrote in Yiddish. He said, because there are things you can say in Yiddish more perfectly than in any. All right. He said, if a man's a mean, miserable man, he said it takes three or four words in English, but one in Jewish, in Yiddish, you know, just to say it or whatever. But the thing is, speaking in the bitterness of the soul, and that's what Job has begun to do now. And it's one of those things that if you catch yourself and you find yourself and you're speaking in the bitterness of your soul, do a mercy to everyone around you and shut your mouth. Go into the prayer closet. Pour it out to God. God's going to understand. God knows what it's like. Jesus knows what it's like to be on the cross and believing that God had forsaken him. All right? Go talk to him about it. Don't put your hoy on everyone else that's around you. He said, I will say unto God, do not condemn me. Show me wherefore thou contendest with me. You know, when a person's struggling and trying to get this thing straight on salvation, this is a common thing. God, what's wrong? Show me what's wrong. Come on, why don't you show me? Because you're a bonehead who's been trying to show you, and you won't look. Verse 3, is it good unto thee that thou should oppress, that thou should despise the work of thine hands, and shine upon the counsel of the wicked? Hast thou eyes of flesh, or seest thou as a man seeth? Well, God's going to answer that one day in the man of Jesus Christ, in the person of Jesus Christ. And he'll come down with a man's eyes, and he'll come down with a man's flesh. And he'll stand there and look at men, and he'll speak. And he'll say, which one of you convinceth me of sin? All right? And when he does, he's going to have the answer from men. And you won't be able to say these kind of things to him. Are they days as the days of a man? Are they years as a man's days? No, they were cut off, Job, when he came down. That thou inquirest after mine iniquity and searchest after my sin? Thou knowest that I am not wicked. Oh, yeah? Go ahead, tell God that. You know, you'd be amazed how many people in their heart, really, honestly, well, technically I realized I've sinned, but they, in their heart of hearts, they don't believe they're a wicked person. They believe they're just. They believe that if God could really look and see why they did what they did, oh, I'm a victim and understand and such. Oh, you know, and here's Job telling them, you know I'm not wicked, God. Anybody here want to dare say that to God? And he goes on and he says this. There's none that can deliver out of thine hand. Verse 8. Thine hands have made me and fashioned me together round about, yet thou dost destroy me. Remember, I beseech thee that thou hast made me as the clay, and wilt thou bring me into dust again? Hast thou not poured me out as milk and curdled me like cheese? Thou hast clothed me with skin and flesh, and hast fenced me with bones and sinews. Thou hast granted me life and favor, and thy visitation hath preserved my spirit. And these things hast thou hid in thine heart. I know that this is with thee. If I sin, then thou markest me, and thou wilt not acquit me for my iniquity. If I be wicked, woe unto me, and if I be righteous, yet will I not lift up my head. I'm full of confusion, therefore see thou mine affliction. You know, he can't get it straight. And this is really, those of you, if I've ever dealt with you and you're not sure if you're saved and you're not sure if you're lost and you can't get this thing straight and you're finally understanding, I hope I have been the most tender friend that you've ever known and has loved you, because you're in this state here. You're just full of confusion and you can't get it right. And, you know, and at one point you're okay, and the other point you're not. Why's God done this to me? And it's amazing. And I get the same questions from all of them. Sooner or later, they're all going to say, well, I'm just reprobate. Oh, God hates me. Blah, 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 blah. You just be amazed at the things. Yeah, I can almost set my watch. All right, here they go. They're about to, all right, they said it. And it's sad to me because it's a lost art in America.
Yes, sir. Sure is.
There's so few people who know how to deal with people that way anymore. And to go through that with them. They don't know how to do it. And there was a time when every man was taught and shown how to deal with people for years even, to bring them to Christ so that they could see for themselves and finally have that moment. The Apostle Paul talks about that grace wherein we stand. You know why I want to see people get saved? Because the moment my conscience was finally free, the moment I finally stood in the grace of Jesus Christ, and peace like a river came into my soul, it was just the greatest thing that ever happened to me. It just, the wonder of it all, it was just a wonder beyond anything. And I long for that for every person that I meet. And there has never, ever been in the history of the English-speaking people as hard a time to bring people to that as there is today.
That's right.
We'll close right there. Pastor Hayden.